Hikatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Hikatra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. So today we are grappling with, well, an intellectual tradition that's arguably one of the most powerful toolkits for analyzing modern society, critical theory.
Yeah, it definitely has this reputation, doesn't it, for being dense. Written by extremely smart people, maybe for extremely smart people.
Right. But the questions it asks, they're the ones we face every day, really. Why does the world feel so, I don't know, broken sometimes?
Exactly. And why are we often kind of unhappy despite all the material progress?
Precisely. Our guide today is Stephen Eric Bronner's really comprehensive book, simply called Critical Theory. And our mission here is to give you a clear, accessible path through it all.
Uh-huh. Because these ideas, even though they started nearly a century ago, are absolutely vital for understanding things like power, media, and, well, all the polarization we see in 2024.
And Bronner puts forward this really powerful challenge, doesn't he? We live in this age of amazing technology, you know, material comfort, democratic ideals everywhere.
Yet, unfreedom, inequality, deep irrationality, it all persists.
Yeah. And critical theory, he argues, gives us the essential diagnosis for these modern pathologies.
And Bronner, he isn't just some academic commentator looking from the outside.
No, he's got a direct stake. Distinguished professor at Rutgers, scholar activist. And importantly, he studied directly under Herbert Marcuse.
That's huge. Marcuse, one of the original Frankfurt School thinkers. So Bronner isn't just reading old texts. He really absorbed the methodology, you know, from the source.
It gives him this incredible insight, right? But what makes his take really distinctive, I think, is his commitment to making these complex ideas accessible.
Yeah, taking them out of the ivory tower. He wants students, general readers, activists, anyone interested, really, to see CT not as some historical artifact,
but as a living tradition, something we could actually use today in the fight against injustice.
Exactly. So his book is basically a demystification project. Yeah. It wants to correct that common idea that CT is just too pessimistic or, you know, politically stuck.
Paralyzed, yeah.
Right.
He frames it as fundamentally about change.
Right.
Okay, so let's dig into the book's core mechanics. Mm-hmm. What's the absolute non-negotiable principle defining critical theory, according to Bronner?
Well, it really comes down to the methodology. It's radically interdisciplinary. They just refuse to stay in one academic box. Mm-hmm. They pull together philosophy, sociology, psychology, political economy, the whole lot. The goal was to grasp the totality of social life.
So you can't just look at, say, the housing crisis and call it purely an economic problem.
No, exactly. You have to see how that inequality impacts mental health, what media people consume to cope, how it shapes their worldview. It's all connected.
Right, the totality.
And that leads straight to their practical goal, which they called praxis.
Praxis. The unity of theory and practice.
Precisely. The aim isn't just to understand the world. It's to change it. Bronner really hammers home that CT offers a practical framework for, well, emancipation.
But okay, if the goal is social change, why is critical theory sometimes feel so abstract? You know, why isn't it easier to mobilize around?
That's the inherent tension, isn't it? And Bronner tackles it head on. The theory has to be deep enough first. It has to diagnose the root causes, which are often hidden, you know, beneath common sense.
Ah, okay. So if the problem isn't just about what people have, but also about what they want or desire,
then you need a really sophisticated tool to analyze that desire. Abstract thought is kind of necessary if you want fundamental change, not just superficial tweaks.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so before they could diagnose the 20th century's issues, they build on earlier thinkers. Let's look at that intellectual DNA.
Right. It starts with Hegel and the dialectic, this core idea that history, society, they're not static. They're not just there.
They're dynamic, driven by conflict, contradiction.
And eventual synthesis, yeah. So for Hegel, contradiction isn't some error in the system.
It's the engine driving it forward.
Exactly. And this lets the critical theorists reject the idea that this is just how things are. The world can change because it's always, always in motion.
Okay. Then comes Marx. He gave them the critique of capitalism. Bronner focuses on alienation.
That separation of the worker from the product of their labor, from their own creative potential.
And commodity fetishism.
It's huge and still so relevant. It's that incredible insight into how market relationships basically hide the human labor involved.
Right. Like you buy a new phone.
Yeah. You see the price tag, the transaction between you and the store. But commodity fetishism points out what's hidden. Where did the minerals come from? Who assembled it? Under what conditions?
We just see the shiny object, the thing with a price. We don't see the complex, maybe exploitative human story behind it.
Exactly. The human element gets erased. And then you've got Max Weber bringing in the iron cage.
The critique of rationalization.
Right. Weber saw the world getting increasingly organized by this cold, calculating efficiency. He called it instrumental reason.
Logic detached from ethics or human values.
Yeah, it's the logic that says, well, this process is good because it's efficient, regardless of the human cost. It traps us in bureaucracy, in systems of control.
So the Institute for Social Research starts in 1923. The first generation, Adorno, Horkheimer, they're soaked in these ideas.
Yeah.
But they're also facing this moment of profound crisis.
Oh, absolutely. Failed socialist revolutions, the rise of fascism, totalitarianism.
Yeah.
The world had gone terribly wrong. They had to ask, you know, if Marx was right about capitalism's flaws, why weren't the working classes rising up? Why were they seemingly integrated, even passive?
And their answer was pretty dark, but maybe intellectually necessary. That reason itself, the Enlightenment Project, had somehow turned toxic.
That's the core of their paradox of enlightenment, the very same instrumental calculation that allowed for incredible factory efficiency. That same logic enabled the calculated bureaucratic horrors of the Holocaust. Reason turned against itself.
Chilling.
Mm.
And that led them to the culture industry.
Yes. Their argument that mass media Hollywood films, standardized pop music, all that predictable entertainment, it wasn't just innocent fun. It was functioning like a factory.
Factory.
Standardized, formulaic cultural products. Designed, they argued, to create passive, predictable consumers. People satisfied enough, distracted enough, never to question the status quo.
Now, that concept, it sometimes gets accused of being elitist, doesn't it? Like, are they just sneering at ordinary people enjoying a pop song or a movie?
It's a common critique and a fair one to raise. Bronner helps clarify by emphasizing their focus was on the methodology. They weren't really criticizing pleasure itself.
Ah, it was the standardization, the commercialization.
Exactly. The way pleasure was being manufactured and sold in a way that flattened out genuine critique or dissent. They saw a kind of cultural monoculture designed to prevent anything truly authentic or potentially rebellious from emerging.
Okay, that's a crucial distinction. So, moving past the war, we get to Hubert Marcuse, Bronner's mentor. He updates the critique with One-Dimensional Man.
Right. Marcuse is dealing with a different world now. Post-war affluence, at least in the West. People weren't being controlled primarily through deprivation anymore. They were, in a way, being controlled through satisfaction.
How does that work?
Well, Marcuse argued that advanced industrial society provides so much material comfort, the gadgets, the conveniences, endless entertainment, that it effectively eliminates the desire for fundamental change. Why rock the boat if you're comfortable?
This sounds like repressive tolerance.
That's exactly it. Yeah. Liberal societies appear to allow dissent, right? Free speech and all that. But Marcuse argued this tolerance is often repressive because it channels any real opposition into harmless forms.
It's co-opted.
Totally. Think about corporations adopting social justice language for marketing or selling rebellious as fashion. The system absorbs the critique, neutralizes its sting, and sells it back to you as a lifestyle choice. Control through comfort and the illusion of choice.
So, if Adorno and Horkheimer were quite pessimistic about reason and mass culture, where did the hope come back in? Bronner points to Jürgen Habermas.
Habermas made a really crucial move. He didn't throw out reason entirely. Instead, he distinguished between that problematic instrumental reason,
the cold calculating logic,
and what he called communicative reason.
Mm.
This is about rational discussion aimed at mutual understanding, people engaging in dialogue to find truth together, not just to win an argument or push an agenda.
And he warned about the colonization of the life world. What does that mean in practice?
Okay, so the life world is basically the realm of shared culture, family, relationships, genuine human connection, the everyday world where we understand each other.
Right.
The system is the sphere dominated by instrumental logic, the market, the state bureaucracy.
Correct.
Colonization happens when that system logic, the market logic, invades and starts to damage the life world.
Okay, give me an example.
Think about how we rate everything now. Uber drivers, restaurants, even dates on apps sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Or schools run solely on performance metrics and standardized tests.
Ah, so the logic of the market efficiency calculation transaction starts to take over human relationships.
Precisely. Every interaction risks becoming transactional, measured. It damages genuine connection.
So what was Habermas's solution?
It's fundamentally democratic. He argued, we need to revitalize the public sphere, create spaces for genuine, unconstrained, rational dialogue, what he called an ideal speech situation, where communicative reason can actually push back against manipulation and system logic.
This all brings us nicely to the core themes Bronner pulls out. These ideas really speak to today, don't they?
Absolutely. First, that ongoing critique of instrumental reason. You see it constantly. When decisions are made purely based on optimizing a metric, increasing profit, or maximizing efficiency without seriously considering the human or environmental cost, that's instrumental reason in action.
We have to ask,
yeah,
what's the purpose behind the efficiency?
Exactly. And then there's the power of ideology in the culture industry. Bronner really shows ideology isn't just like a set of wrong ideas someone holds.
It's embedded in our daily lives, yeah. Our entertainment, our desires.
Yeah, even in the algorithms that shape what we see. Think about social media feeds. They often create these one-dimensional echo chambers reinforcing biases. It's like the culture industry, but personalized and on steroids for the 21st century.
That's powerful. And what about the link between the individual and society?
That's the dialectical relationship. Critical theory insists that a lot of personal distress, anxiety, depression, even political polarization, isn't just individual. It often reflects deeper systemic social problems.
So personal well-being and social change are kind of intertwined. You can't fully fix one without addressing the other.
That's the idea. And despite the heavy critique, Bronner really emphasizes the ultimate hopefulness, the unfinished project of emancipation. CT refuses to accept that this is just how things are.
It holds on to the possibility of a better future, a society free from oppression.
Yes, that commitment to praxis, to change, remains central. It's fundamentally a hopeful project, even when its diagnosis seems bleak.
And the tradition has produced some incredibly memorable, almost aphoristic statements.
Oh, definitely. Lines that really stick with you.
I always come back to that core idea. The critique of society is the critique of consciousness.
It's so powerful. Social change has to start internally, right? Recognizing how oppressive systems are maintained by the beliefs we absorb, the things we take for granted about ourselves and the world.
Yeah. And that line, I think it's originally Walter Benjamin's that Bronner discusses. There is no document of civilization which is not at the same time a document of barbarism.
Oof. Yeah. That forces you to look critically at everything. Every great achievement, every cultural monument, every technological leap. It's almost always built on some form of exploitation or domination or hidden cost. You have to see both sides.
It demands a really nuanced view, doesn't it? Not just celebrating progress, not just dismissing it entirely either.
Exactly. And then, of course, Marcuse's haunting line about modern control. A comfortable, smooth, reasonable, democratic unfreedom prevails.
That just nails it, doesn't it? The feeling of being comfortable, maybe even feeling informed or politically aware, but ultimately feeling powerless to change the big structures. That smooth unfreedom.
It's chillingly accurate sometimes, but Bronner's book doesn't just leave you with the theory. It equips you, the listener, to apply it. Let's talk practical applications.
Okay. First up, media literacy and critical consumption. Apply that culture industry lens to your own habits.
Right. When you're scrolling through Instagram or TikTok, ask yourself, is this content designed to make me think critically, or is it primarily optimized to keep me passively consuming, clicking, watching ads?
Is it fostering reflection or just reinforcing my role as a consumer?
Exactly. And then there's the workplace.
Yeah.
Use the critique of instrumental reason.
How does that look?
Well, look at how decisions are made. Are they genuinely focused on human well-being, creativity, sustainable value? Or is it all about hitting metrics, optimizing the system, treating employees purely as resources to be managed efficiently?
That constant pressure for quantifiable output, sometimes at the expense of burnout or genuine quality.
That's pure instrumental reason. Recognizing it is the first step.
And finally, thinking about Habermas in the public sphere. When you engage in discussions, especially online.
Yeah, evaluate the nature of that interaction. Is it actually moving towards mutual understanding? Is there a genuine exchange of ideas based on evidence and maybe some respect, even in disagreement?
Or is it just about emotional manipulation? Scoring points, owning the other side, reinforcing tribal divides.
The sheer amount of outrage-driven content and performative conflict online really shows how that instrumental the logic of winning, of engagement metrics, is colonizing our public conversations, pushing out communicative reason.
It's sobering. Bronner really succeeds in taking this potentially intimidating tradition and making it feel incredibly relevant, almost urgent.
Definitely. It changes how you look at everything, politics, advertising, technology, even your own feelings.
What was the biggest takeaway or surprise for you revisiting it through Bronner's lens?
I think it was just how alive he makes it feel. It's not presented as a finished historical object. He shows how the core methodology, that critical dialectical approach, can constantly adapt to analyze new problems. Algorithmic bias, surveillance capitalism, the new forms of authoritarianism. CT gives you the tools. It's a framework for ongoing skepticism.
Yeah, that adaptability is key.
Yeah.
For me, the most valuable lesson, the thing I hope you take away, is that powerful skepticism CT offers. That fundamental refusal to accept the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
The way things are is not the way they have to be. It equips you to look beneath the surface, to see the hidden structures of power and ideology that shape our reality.
And that ability to see the invisible roles, that's mm-hmm. the starting point for real freedom, isn't it?
It really is. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.